continuing enhanced budget review of the University of Minnesota. And we have submitted some questions that we wanted the university to address. And so I believe we're starting with Mr. Fitzenreuter. And I see that Regent Simmons is in the audience. Welcome. Regent Frobenius is in the audience. Any other regents here? Regent Hunter is usually always here. But where is he? Oh, he's over in the house. That's right. They have their hearing the same time. And Mr. Sullivan has joined. Mr. Fitzenreuter, welcome.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Richard Fitzenreuter. I'm the Chief Financial Officer and Treasurer at the University of Minnesota, and with me, as Chairwoman mentioned, is Provost Tom Sullivan from the university as well. I'd like to start today. I believe you all have a copy of the handout, and what I'd like to do is take you through that handout, and Tom Sullivan and I will play tag team here, and I think it's best from our perspective if members have questions along the way, we're happy to pause and take those questions, or if the committee would like to wait till the end, but I think we're here for a conversation,
right.
So if you get a question, let's jump on it right away.
Members should feel free to ask questions, and I promise to be respectful.
Okay, on the first slide, the agenda, we're going to just give you a high-level view of the University of Minnesota's budget, have some discussion of the student support and the goals, and we also have included, I believe, a handout, a narrative handout that answers some specific questions that were posed to us from the committee. I'm not going to spend a great deal of time in that level of detail. It's the narrative answers are there. We can hit some highlights of that information. But I think the other questions that aren't in that handout, I think we'll hit as we go through the presentation. Madam Chair, members, one of the first questions I get, if you look at the slide labeled right after the agenda, fiscal year 2008-2009 operating budget, one of the first questions people often ask me is just how big is the university's budget? And the university's budget on an annual basis approximates about $3 billion. Now, at the University of Minnesota, the budget for accounting purposes often gets categorized into two buckets. One of those buckets is called sponsored expenditures, and I'll talk a little bit more about that shortly. But when we use the word sponsored expenditures, we mean that someone external from the university is providing funds for us, and we're required in that process to do a certain kind of work. It's sponsored by an external entity. It's around, we spend on average around $450 to $500 million a year. That varies across fiscal years because awards are often up and down. Generally, they're growing, but how much we spend in any 1 year is a function of the grant we get. Is it a one-year grant, a three-year grant, et cetera. But sponsored expenditures are not very fungible. They are restricted as to purpose and must be spent for the purpose at which they give us the money. Now, I'm not an accountant. I was a philosophy major. I don't know why the accountants decided to say, well, if we have sponsored expenditures, then everything else the university spends its money on must be non-sponsored. So that's the way we sort of begin the dialogue about the university's budget. There are sponsored activities that are restricted and unique activities with an external party. Then everything else is non-sponsored, and that's really the meat and potatoes of the annual operating budget of the University of Minnesota. And that runs about $2.5 billion. And what I want to do on the next slide is share with you on that $3 billion budget some of the major funding sources with that budget. And as you can see on the chart, the O&M state appropriation, that's the block grant that comes through the Higher Ed Committee, represents about 23% of the university's total budget, just under 25%. But then there's the state special appropriation that are, again, a form of restricted spending, not as restricted as sponsored expenditures, but are items that are in, I believe, four specific state specials. So between the state special and the block grant that the state gives us, the state supports about 26% of the total overall revenues at the university. Tuition, which in this chart is really in two pieces, the university fee and tuition, runs about 20%, 21% of the university's total revenues. Indirect cost recovery, when we do a sponsored project with the federal government, more often than with any other sponsoring entity, we get reimbursed for indirect costs. And this particular piece of the pie, about 4% of our funding, is the reimbursement we get from mostly federal agencies that represent that overhead. So, for example, if we do a $100,000 grant from NIH, we'll get an additional roughly $50,000 on top of that. And that expense, that indirect expense, covers the cost of the lights, the equipment, the lab, the facilities that the research occurs in. So there's direct expenses of the grant and indirect expenses of the grant. That indirect revenue is really reimbursement to the university for money we've already spent supporting that activity when that research takes place in the lab, in a lab at the University of Minnesota. Next piece, center reserves. I think I've had a dialogue here with this committee before. Center reserves is a unique fund controlled by the Board of Regents. It represents really the institutional unrestricted resources of the institution. And it's targeted at, to represent on an annual basis, about 4% of the state appropriation. I've mentioned to this committee the last time I was here that that particular reserve should be at $28 million. At this point in time, that reserve sits at about $14 million due to the fact that investment income is down slightly at the university because interest rates are down, as well as the fact that this past year we lost $9.9 million on a Washington Mutual bond because of the global economic crisis when Washington Mutual ran into its bankruptcy problems.
Mr. Fitzenreiter, do you do your own investing, the university? You're not with the State Investment Board.
Madam Chair, members, we on the university side of the equation have what's called the Consolidated Endowment Fund. That's money that's really legacy money from the land grant, from minerals, et cetera, that sit on the books of the university. We have Stuart Mason, who reports to me as the Chief Investment Officer. That fund totals about $1 billion, and that's invested through that office. We also manage the cash flow of the institution and invest that. There's also money invested. All new gifts at the university are deposited with either the Medical Foundation or the University of Minnesota Foundation. So there's additional endowment money managed through those organizations. We manage on our endowment side about $1 billion and dropping slightly due to the economy.
Right.
Auxiliary enterprises, 9% of the total, represent our activities around intercollegiate athletics, housing, parking, food service are the primary revenue sources for that slice of the pie. Internal sales, we do operate a variety of what we call internal service organizations, printing services, fleet services that do business inside the university. This isn't business we do with outside customers. It's business we do inside. Miscellaneous income and sales and fees are money that when, for example, when the university has spare time on a large magnet that we're not doing, happen to be doing research on, we do sell that time. We're aggressive, particularly in the last 8 to 10 years at the university, by searching out new external sources of revenue to complement our budgets, and we're continually trying to find ways to leverage the resources we have to find additional new income through the sale of our excess time and equipment or labs or items like that. Restricted gifts and endowments, about 11%, varies between 10 and 11% of the budget. That's money that comes over to the university to be expended in our accounting system from the foundations primarily. Remember that how an endowment works is the goal in an endowment is intergenerational equity. You don't want to spend into the principal. So the goal in investing endowment proceeds is to invest for that long term. There is an annual payout rate off of those endowments. At the university, generally that endowment payout is moving to about a 4.5% payout on a trailing average of about 5 years of the value of the endowment. That's designed, again, to come over to the university, and that piece of the pie reflects that income coming into the university. By and large, that income, again, is restricted. It's not as fungible as other parts of the budget, and I'll talk about that shortly. And then you see the slice that is the sponsored research. Those really, underneath that pie chart, those slices, there's approximately 70 additional funds. I didn't want to go into all that level of detail here that our financial system tracks. These are the big pieces of the pie to give you a sense of where the overall money at the university comes from. The next slide is just a snapshot of that revenue over time, adjusted for inflation. And as you can see in the maroon part of this chart, the lower part of the chart, that represents the inflation adjusted from 06, from 1978 through 06, state funds adjusted for inflation. So you can see the overall, and we're appreciative of every penny you get us, but adjusted for inflation, the state money is about where it was in the 1978. You can see the tuition and fee bar has, of course, grown adjusted for inflation. And then everything else, less auxiliaries, is the gray bar.
Madam Chair.
And Senator Roebling.
Can I ask, if this is adjusted for inflation and all it showed was growth, no, it shouldn't show growth that was caused by inflation, right?
It's, Madam Chair, members, it's taking the value of a dollar today and making it what it's worth, making the dollars constant in value.
So
anything, if the line was headed up like the gray bar does, we're showing real growth in revenues above inflation. If it's flat over this period, it means that there really hasn't been any net growth in revenue above inflation.
Right. But it is showing that the state kept up with the rate of inflation.
Madam Chair, Senator, you're absolutely right. It's kept up with inflation.
And Mr. Futzenreiter, why don't you have 07 and 08 on the chart?
Madam Chair, it's just the data that was used for the chart. We could update it further for 08 and 09.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Senator Latz.
Mr. Futzenreiter, is the inflation that you're using for this chart the consumer price index, or is there a more focused inflationary rate that would apply to higher education costs?
Madam Chair, Senator, my colleague back here, Peter Zetterberg, who put the chart together, says it's the CPI. There is a higher education price index that actually runs about 1% on average higher than the CPI. The higher education price index is loaded more in a basket of goods that reflects higher education spending. But that index is also tilted a little bit more towards salaries than the CPI. In this example, we use the CPI. If you use the higher education price index, I would venture to say the state probably hasn't kept up with inflation, because I know over time the HEPA index has run faster. I'll be honest, that index is controversial. So I think the CPI was the one we use. I'll admit, I don't think the CPI represents the basket of goods that higher ed purchases, because in that case, it's more loaded with things that aren't necessarily bought in the higher ed environment. But to keep it simple, it's CPI. Turning to the next slide, at the University of Minnesota, we track expenditures not only by what we call object of expenditure, but by function. We are a people business. What you see on the left pie chart here, object of expenditures, is when you look at the institution as a whole, we're about, our salary and fringe costs are about 63%, just about 2/3 of the spending. If you go into an academic or support unit at the university, and you look at the budgets. So you look at CLA's budget or IT's budget or some of the other units. The percent reliance of their budget, the percent spent on salaries and fringe is in the neighborhood of 90 to 94, 95%. The reason this particular number is lower when you look institutionally is the utility bills are in here. And if you strip that out, people are really, the budgets at the university are really people budgets. There's not a lot of money left in the other categories in the budgets of the university, so that when we face budget reductions, it really does fall quite heavily on people. It's difficult to avoid holding positions vacant or laying people off.
Mr. Fitzenreiter, are these charts with just the money from the legislature, or this is all funds?
All funds, all funds. Madam Chair.
Madam Chair.
Senator Roebling.
Is the 2%, that's your debt for bonding? Or what is the 2%? Equipment and capital assets. Oh, it's assets. Where is your bonding debt?
Madam Chair, I believe, Senator, it would be in all other. I believe the equipment and capital assets is really spending on equipment, purchasing a microscope, purchasing equipment.
And, Madam Chair?
Senator Roebling.
You know how the state tries to keep it about a 3% for our bonding debt? What is your percentage, would you estimate for bonding debt?
Madam Chair, Senator, we're about the same percentage, around 3.1% of debt to operations.
Okay.
So we have a similar percentage.
Okay. Proceed.
And, Madam Chair, the right pie chart shows you how the relative share that we also keep track of in our accounting system on how much we spend on instruction, research, auxiliaries, again, institutional support, plant, et cetera.
Madam Chair?
Senator Wieger.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Fitzenreiter, is 36 cents on the dollar about average for a classroom? Or could you give me some trend information on that?
Madam Chair, Senator, we can get you this these categories by trend. We absolutely can. What that instruction represents is the cost, basically, is the cost of the faculty and related salaries in the classroom. It's really purely in the classroom. And we can show you that over time. It's really salaries of the faculty teaching or TAs or graduate assistants in the classroom.
And, Madam Chair, in addition to any trend, if you have any comparative with comparable institutions. Thank you.
Madam Chair?
Senator Roebling.
I'm trying to understand the support or the difference between academic support and student services and institutional support.
Madam Chair, members, the institutional support versus academic support, I'll give you an example. The institutional support will include expenditures, for example, for libraries. Would be an institutional support. We can get you a copy of the specific definitions for each one of these. These are national standards of how the money, how in these definitions, and because we all try to report nationally for the for these comparisons with other institutions, there's standard definitions that we follow. So we'll be happy to get that for the committee so you know what's in the buckets. Academic support and student services, be advising, as well as the folks in the admissions office processing applications. That would be examples in that particular bucket.
Public service?
Extension, outreach activities. I see another, Senator Lynch.
Oh, I'm sorry, Senator Lynch.
Madam Chair, I was just going to say, I think that to have description on each of those areas in that function chart would be helpful. So we do appreciate that follow-up.
2% in research, that seems kind of small. Is that because most of the research money is sponsored?
Madam Chair, you're exactly right.
Oh. Nice
speaking of that, next slide. The sponsored awards. again, I mentioned earlier that we spend between $450 and $500 million dollars a year in sponsored expenditures. However, our awards are always substantially above that because the awards represent, in many cases, when a faculty member gets an award, it may be an award for 3 years. So in the 2008, we had awards totaling $675 million. You can see that by college who the primary or the majority of these awards and go to, and it's clearly the medical school, IT, and public health that are the lion's share of the sponsorship awards. We had an 8.3% increase over 2007, and you can see in the chart that some of the increases in IT, vet, med, and pharmacy were and nursing were quite large. I do want to take a minute here to tell the committee that we are mobilizing very rapidly for the stimulus package. We know that there are enormous opportunities in that stimulus package for the University of Minnesota to garner increased funds back to Minnesota. We've begun to organize around that. Committees are formed. Our VP for research has started a very substantial effort. We met on it this morning to get the word out and get faculty engaged in developing those grant applications. We see an enormous positive. We think we're mobilized better than many states right now, many higher ed institutions, to get ready to put those applications in. We do have some challenges in this area. These applications don't just get put together by faculty. There's an enormous amount of support staff. There's going to be an enormous amount of accountability around these dollars. There's going to be increased reporting, increased tracking. Some people say like we've never seen before, and that's going to take staff and resources, which frankly will add to the financial challenge that the university faces over the next couple of months just to get ready for this money. But we've got to mobilize for it because there's enormous opportunity to bring some of these tax dollars back to Minnesota.
Madam Chair.
Senator Tomasoni.
Mr. Fitzenreiter, as long as you brought up the stimulus package, there was a headline in a paper this morning that said stimulus stipulation may force change in governor's planned higher education cuts. Do you know anything about that?
Mr. Fitzenreiter.
Madam Chair, Senator, I'm familiar with and have read several times the state's or the stabilization fund that's in the stimulus bill, and I understand how the bill is supposed to work, but it's pretty confusing as to how it's going to work because I think it's really up to the governor and the legislature to somehow figure out how much money is going to flow in which direction. It's clear in that stabilization bill that public higher education institutions in Minnesota should get some money out of that, but how that money will be used is... it can be used for education in general. It can be used to mitigate tuition increases for in-state students, and it can be used, the way I read the language, for facilities. But I also understand it's the governor who gets to kind of decide that because he decides how the federal money goes. But I know that we should get some of that money. I can do the math, but I just don't know how it's going to come or when it's going to come or what strings might come with it. We're anxious to learn.
So is there...
Senator Tomasoni.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is there any indication in that in order to get federal money, whatever cuts the governor has proposed may have to be reduced?
Madam Chair, Senator, I could probably talk for 20 minutes about it.
Well, you know what? We don't want you to because next week we're going to have some time when our joint committees are meeting next Tuesday after we vote on the Regents. And we thought we might use that extra time to get some feedback on what's going to happen with the federal stimulus package for higher ed. So maybe you could just save your comments and see between now and next Tuesday what else we can find out.
There's not a simple yes or no here.
He said it's 20 minutes.
Madam Chair, Senator, unfortunately not.
Okay.
And I will say that I think it's going to take enormous coordination between the executive and legislative branch to make it work for everybody.
Mm-hmm. Good luck.
Madam Chair.
I can do it.
Madam Chair, members, the next slide, just to highlight the changing mix of state appropriations and tuition. As you can see in this chart, in 1997-98 fiscal year, the state money, this is a relationship between state money and tuition. That state money in that equation was 71% and tuition revenue represented 29%. Today, that mix has changed considerably where the state appropriation represents 56% of that total, and tuition and fees represent 44%. And based on, you know, I'll just say this, that based on the governor's cut, where he reduced us down to $627 million, our tuition revenue today is about $625 million. Now, I've watched it around the country, and we'll be one of the, depending on how this all comes out, and I don't think the economy's getting better, that, and depending on how much tuition goes up and how much more we're cut, that the lines between the amount of state support and tuition, that those revenue lines are going to cross at this institution for really the first time. That's a sea change. It's happened in a lot of institutions across the country. There aren't many that are left that way, and I think Minnesota's headed to become like everyone else, where the tuition revenue as a total number will exceed the state appropriation next fiscal year. And that's just a footnote to what's happening here. I'm not commenting whether that's good or bad, but it is, I think, going to happen this time, and it will happen at the University of Minnesota for the first time. Why is that state appropriation and tuition so important to the university? Those dollars, and it's about $1.2 billion when you add the two together, it's 93% of the budget at CLA. 93%, and I'll show you the other revenues in a moment, but 93% of the budget in CLA is supported by these two revenue sources. It's 78% of the budget at IT, 75% of the budget at CFAN, 70% of what we spend on instruction. You had the question earlier about the instruction function code, as we call it. 70% of what we spend in instruction is off of these two revenue sources. It covers 72% of all the money we spend on faculty compensation. So just give you a flavor of how important these two sources of revenue are to the university in terms of supporting the budgets of some important colleges and the support for the faculty and instruction at the institution. I want to turn on the next slide to the share of the state budget that goes to higher ed, just to give you some sense of the trend here. This particular pie chart, I think you've probably seen. We hope ours is a little clearer than other ones I've seen. But this represents the governor's original biennial budget before the next revenue forecast, $33.6 billion. And higher education represented 8.5% of that piece of the pie. When you turn to the next page, the University of Minnesota, in that 8.5%, we get roughly a little less than half of it. And what the next chart is showing is the University of Minnesota's share of the state general fund pie, going all the way back to 1971. And we peaked back in 71, or else the records don't go back any farther. But we used to be about 8.3% of the state budget. We all know that the state has faced enormous pressures in other parts of its budget. It's not that we haven't gotten increases in appropriation, but today the University of Minnesota sits at about 4% of the state budget, about a little less than half of that 8.5%. And in the governor's recs, we'll head down to about 3.6% of the state budget. Just give you a sense of the trend on, and again, this is, I worry about putting this chart up because I'm not trying to criticize how much money you've given us. You have given us more, But as the state budget has grown, we've still become a smaller piece of it because you've had to face costs in health and health and human services, in property tax relief, local government aids, K-12 education. We know that those pieces of the pie are growing more rapidly than the other pieces of the pie. We've been asked, and there's in your packet on the next page, we've been asked, well, where does the state appropriation go? How do we where does it go inside the university? And what you have on the left side of this chart are the major organizational units that receive a piece of the state appropriation. You can also see that's in column A. That's the block grant. You can see in column B the allocation of the state specials, and the total general fund support through the higher ed bill is in column D. And then the MinCare money and the cigarette tax money are focused really in the Academic Health Center and well as a piece in Rochester. So then you see the grand total in column F. That is where the actual dollars are allocated of the state appropriation. That's a question that people have asked us in the past. Where does the state specials, the block grant, and the MinCare and cigarette money go? On the next slide, if you turn the page, this shows the major academic units as well as a couple of the campuses as to the mix of their particular revenues. So I'll draw your attention, for example, to the law school. Just you can see law there. And the green bar, green part of that bar, represents their share of the state appropriation. And then you can see the blue bar, for those that are fortunate enough to have the color slides, that their tuition revenue. And then you can see the other miscellaneous revenues. You can see that when budget cuts come to the university, that you could, I'm not picking on law, I have a student there as a second-year law student, but you could close some of those schools and not garner a great deal of savings, that the state money is, he's a former dean of the law school sitting next to me, the bulk of the state dollars, of course, are located where I think you'd want us to put it. It's in the medical school. It's in liberal arts. It's in IT. You can see the Carlson School, for example, is more reliant on tuition than state money. So this gives you a flavor of where we have to go when budget cuts come, is we have to look to where the money is. So budget cuts do fall heavily on some of these areas. When a budget cut comes from the state. It's frankly, all units are facing budget cuts, and we'll talk about that in a minute, but you have to understand that when we get a big budget cut, we have to look at where the money is, where the money's allocated in the budget to, and they face a substantial part of the burden.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Thank you. Madam Chair, Mr. Fitzenreiter. For column D on MinCare and cigarette allocation, could you elaborate a little bit more on that allocation and how much for each area for MinCare and cigarette? And I didn't actually know that MinCare went there. So,
Madam Chair, Senator, we get about $2.5 million a year in appropriation from the MinCare funds.
$2.5 million.
It's a pretty small piece of the pie. The bulk of that money, about $22 million, is money that the history, I'll give you the history of it. When the Ventura administration created the tobacco endowment, we received proceeds off of that tobacco endowment. The tobacco endowments were wiped out in the last budget problem of the state. They used that money, and they replaced it with general fund dollars that are tied to the tobacco money. Now, that's been made an appropriation now in the higher ed bill. So we get about $22 million. That's really replacement proceeds that had its origination in the tobacco endowment back in the Ventura administration.
Yes, Senator Roebling.
Madam Chair, on page 12, what is design? It's about the fifth one down.
Madam Chair, Senator, the College of Design, Architecture, Design. Oh, okay. That's what that one is.
And Vice President Futzenreuter?
Fitz.
Futzenreuter. Could you explain what ICR is?
Madam Chair, ICR is indirect cost recovery funds, which are reimbursements on sponsored research from the mostly the federal agencies to cover indirect costs of activity occurring in the lab. They pay for the lights, the equipment that are used. And so if we get, as I mentioned earlier, we get a $100,000 grant from the federal government to do pay for the direct costs of research, they'll give us an additional, depending on the granting agency, they're not all the same as you would expect. Ag gives less, NIH gives the most. They'll give us a percentage over that to help pay for the cost. Now, we negotiate that rate with the federal government about every 3 years. Frankly, they don't reimburse us as much as the indirect costs of research actually cost us.
Senator Rubin?
Thank you. It's interesting when you do some of the comparisons here. Why does Duluth, for example, have so much more revenue in fees and sales, you know, as a percent of their total budget than, you know, many of the other institutions? What do they do that would generate that kind of revenue?
Madam Chair, members, the one thing that's probably not the only thing about this chart, when you bring a whole campus in, you end up combining all of the sales activity that goes on. What's not on this chart, because the sales activity is in housing and auxiliaries and intercollegiate athletics, is not in this chart because it's not attributed to CLA or IT. Duluth gets distorted because in this chart, we're including the housing that and auxiliary and food service operations that's on the Duluth campus. That's why it gets distorted. That line for Duluth includes things that if I did a Twin Cities campus compared to Duluth, it wouldn't look as odd.
Vice President Futzenreuter, can I draw from this the conclusion that for those that have the largest amount of tuition and fees associated with their non-sponsored revenues, that the cost of the program does not absorb the cost as much of the tuition fees as, for example, Carlson as opposed to nursing?
Boy, it's a tough question to answer clearly. In part, what you see on here stems from the way we attribute revenues and costs inside the university. You know, at the university, we don't have we have a budget system in which the revenues for CLA, the tuition revenue, is attributed to CLA directly, based on a formula of 75% of the tuition revenue goes to the college bearing the cost of instruction, 25% of the tuition revenue goes to the college where the student's enrolled. So a student in CBS that takes a CLA course, but if CLA teaches it, 75% of that revenue goes to CLA, 25% of it's in the CBS, College of Biological Sciences line. So it's an artifact. These revenues reflect where internally we've decided to send the revenue based on formulas. You know, the question of is it enough to cover cost is not shown on here. It's certainly a number we can calculate.
Madam Chair?
Yes,
I'm not sure I answered your question clearly.
No, I draw another conclusion from what you've said. Senator Roebling?
Thank you, Madam Chair. How come Rochester isn't showing any tuition?
The tuition revenue is attributed in this particular year. I'm not saying going forward, but the tuition is attributed to the college where the student is, whose currently giving the instruction. So if a CLA or an IT or a medical school faculty is giving the instruction, it goes back to that school because they don't have faculty.
Is that what she was asking?
Yet. Yeah. Once they start having faculty and teaching, it will be attributed directly to those, to the place paying for the cost of instruction or where the students enrolled.
So, Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Roebling.
So is Rochester, the state appropriation then is mainly facilities because it isn't including staffing? Or I'm just not clear on that.
At the present time, my understanding, this chart shows where the revenues are attributed based on who bears the cost of instruction or where the student is enrolled. And right now, Rochester is just functioning on the state appropriation. In the future, as they develop faculty that teach, and the faculty are, you know, paid out of the Rochester budget, the tuition will be attributed to the Rochester budget.
Madam Chair.
Senator Roebling.
And that is the goal, or did we decide that the Rochester campus would run and operate differently and that they would always be an extension of other schools? Or are they supposed to develop all of their own administration and faculty on site?
Madam Chair, Senator, if I may respond.
Mr. Sullivan.
We are in a transition at this point, and many of the programs up until this time and presently this year being delivered on the Rochester campus are being delivered from various other campuses, Twin Cities, Duluth, particularly. As we move forward in this transition, and as we actually speak today, Rochester is hiring faculty, and they will be building up that undergraduate cohort, that undergraduate enrollment base, but it'll be a multi-year process to go from delivering the instruction from other campuses as well as electronically to building up their own substantial faculty.
Madam Chair.
Senator Roebling.
Do we expect the student enrollment in the whole system, the U of M system, to also be increasing because of the Rochester campus? Or do we expect to have a drawdown from other campuses as Rochester increases?
Madam Chair, Senator, we will expect there to be an increase. The actual enrollments, the students that matriculate, are largely dependent at the end by market factors. Sometimes we can predict those, sometimes we can't. But as we plan the Rochester campus, we will expect the overall system-wide enrollment to increase. We will not be decreasing other portions of the university to level off for Rochester.
Okay, Madam Chair.
Senator Roebling.
Because if that does start to happen, of course, we would expect decreases on the other campuses in the state contribution as well. I'm hoping you're right that happens, and we have a general increase in the overall system's enrollment. But we'll have to be watchful if that doesn't work out the way we planned, so that as Rochester grows, that those funds are redistributed appropriately and not just grown at one campus and no losses at the other.
Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just very briefly, I think to the program that's being developed at Rochester, it is very much a unique niche and doesn't function now, nor will it function as we think of our other traditional campuses do. And I know today's not the time for that, but it might be interesting for this committee to at some point hear more about the newly released five-year plan from the University of Minnesota Rochester campus.
Madam Chair, Senator Lynch, if I could respond, that's exactly correct. And each of our campuses, as you look at them, have their own uniqueness, their own comparative advantages, and their own particular draw or attention from students. It is market-oriented in that regard. Crookston is very different from Morris. Morris is different from Duluth, and Rochester, your point, will be very different on the ground, functioning, as well as perception than the other campuses.
Okay.
Madam Chair, members, if we could turn to the next slide. We shared this one with this committee earlier. I won't touch on it other than to remind the committee that, as I said at the time, it seems to be repeating itself, where, as you know, that we've had an unallotment in December of $20 million. That $20 million has been assigned to all the academic and support units at the university. We face the governor's January budget cut, and as we all know, we're anxiously waiting to see where the March forecast is and how that next round of budget challenges the state faces. I want to turn to the next page and tell you a little bit about where we are in our planning process. As you know, our fiscal year is the same as the state's fiscal year. We need to have a budget in place by July 1, and we cannot wait to begin planning that. What we have in front of us right now for fiscal 10, which is the most critical year, is, as we know, the governor reduced us in the first year of the biennium by $75.5 million. That's a recurring cut proposed by the governor. There's an additional $2.5 million recurring cut that's a hangover in the budget from last May. So the state cuts roughly $78 million or $156 million over the biennium. But as the president has stated, and I've mentioned, I think, to this committee before, our challenge in the next fiscal year and the fiscal year after that is larger than the state cut because we face additional expenses that we cannot avoid, that we are going to have to find a solution to. And that additional expense next year alone is $55 million. So our challenge is more in the neighborhood of $134 million. When you translate that on the next slide into how do we plan for that and begin to think about it, you can see in fiscal 10, and I'd like to spend the most time here just outlining fiscal 10. We begin with the $78 million cut in fiscal 10. That's the 75.5 from the governor and the hangover of 2.5 from last session. Our additional financial obligations, and we've knocked these costs down as low as we can possibly go, but we face next year a compensation cost, not for a salary increase. This is not a compensation increase in 10 for our employees. We have announced in our budget planning exercise a freeze, of course, subject to collective bargaining. Our planning guidelines to academic and support units presently call for a salary freeze in the first year of the biennium. But despite that freeze, and this goes to the complexity of the university's budget, our fringe rates, which represent retirement, health, workers' comp costs, et cetera, are not set by the University of Minnesota. Those figures are set by the Department of Health and Human Services. It's a federal requirement that they get to approve and decide how we calculate our fringe rates. The fringe rates are what we charge all the academic and support units, and we face roughly a $21 million increase next year because the federal government just 2 years ago changed the rules for us in which we now have to benchmark our fringe rates off of our financial statements. We can't forward project those fringe rates. And as a result, we had to go back and lag them 2 years. So now we have this situation where they go up and down, up and down. And that was something that an individual in Dallas that works for the Department of Health and Human Services decided. So that's a cost we can't change. It's not a cost because we're providing more retirement money or increased health benefits. It's simply the mechanism, the manner in which they decided to save themselves some money. So there was this, a couple years ago, there was a way in which the federal government lowered their cost, saved themselves some money, and now that cost catches up with us, and it's reflected here. And that's a cost we can't avoid. In our budget framework, and we included this as part of our biennial budget request to you, a new $8 million scholarship plan, and the president feels very strongly that despite the reduction in state support of $78 million, that we want to move ahead with a new middle-income scholarship program that we'll talk a little bit more about shortly. We also have what's called the Founders Free Tuition Program, in which the university makes sure that for all those need-based students who come to the university, that their tuition and fees are entirely covered, and next year that cost increase for us will be $4.4 million. We also face facility operating costs, utility, debt, leases, costs that will increase next year of roughly $13.6 million, and we have other strategic, contractual, and safety issues. We are adding additional police to the force on the Twin Cities campus. We have additional technology costs, software licensing fees that are going to add up to roughly $9 million. That represents our almost $134 million challenge. How are we addressing that challenge? Well, two-thirds of that right now, $86 million, as you can see, budget reductions, are now been allocated to academic and support units at the university. They are preparing budget plans to reduce their budgets, a minimum, as you see down at the bottom of the page. That reallocation is currently pegged at 5.2% of operating budgets. I'll give you an example. In CLA, they're now wrestling with a budget cut that approaches $12 million. That's their share of that cut. IT's working, Institute of Technology's working on one that's nearly $6 million. So units are out wrestling with this budget reduction. That would solve two-thirds of that challenge based on budget reductions. The other third, the $44.5 million, is built on an assumption of a 7.5% tuition increase on undergraduate, graduate, and professional revenues next year. Now, I know everyone's going to jump on the 7.5, but I think you need to bear in mind that what we're planning with between the Founders and the Middle Income Scholarship Program, that will substantially reduce that cost. It will eliminate it for all Pell-eligible need-based students at the university and substantially reduce it for Minnesota in-residence students through the $8 million middle-income scholarship program that we're proposing in this framework. Fiscal 11, you can see the assumptions there. The one difference in Fiscal 11 in this planning framework is we're still hopeful.
Madam Chair.
Just a minute. Senator Tomasoni.
Madam Chair, Mr. Fitzenreiter, would you at some point in time be able to tell us what the effective tuition increase would actually be once those other factors are figured in? Or is that something you...
Madam Chair, members of the committee, yes.
Okay.
In the second year of the biennium, the assumption here is for, unlike the first year of the biennium, we would still, like, we are in a competitive market. We, in this planning framework, and again, all of this is preliminary, all likely to change because of the next go-round in the budget, but we still had hopes to do a 2% compensation increase for our faculty in the second year of the biennium, as well as we do face, again, additional founders costs, facility operating costs. But we also will do another reallocation and an increase in tuition here in the second year. The assumption is 6%. Again, this is a planning framework. The important one is Fiscal 10, in my judgment, because We have some urgency to get a budget in place, get people working. It is not easy to take costs out. It takes time. These large budget reductions have to work themselves out, and we don't want to surprise people completely come the 18th of May when you're forced to adjourn or do adjourn, hopefully, and we have a budget. We don't have a lot of time to inform people to cut their budgets, so we've started that process now, and we have budget meetings. I had one today already, that every day we sit down with these units and are going through what the choices are that we're going to face for them to reduce their budgets.
Madam Chair.
Senator Roebling.
In the mid-income scholarship area, there is nothing showing for fiscal year 11. Is that going to disappear? Because there is still Founders Scholarship money.
Madam Chair, fiscal 11 is the increment over fiscal 10. The 8 recurs in this budget. The 8, there's just not an incremental additional bump in the second year of the biennium. But, the Chair, 8 recurs.
But the 4 for the Founders is additional money.
Yes.
And that's an assumption that we're going to get more of those kids into college.
That's right.
Good.
Madam Chair, as I sit here and think about this, you know, we're probably going to have, if the Pell Grant increases and we have the combined state grant, Pell Grant issue, they're bundled. And if we don't unbundle them, there's going to be about $60 million, I understand, that's left. So I'm just sitting here looking at this and thinking, well, if we get to keep it in our division, would it be better to, and I mean that would be a goal, would it be better to say we're going to specifically fund your mid-income scholarship or founder scholars, or would you rather just have it on the base so that you could keep tuition lower? I'm just trying to figure this out because it looks like you have chosen to fund the scholarships is a very high priority, even if it means increasing tuition. But if we put it on the base, potentially you could keep tuition lower.
Madam Chair, members, I think we're anxious to have that dialogue with you as this process proceeds. You could say, well, don't do the middle-income scholarship, lower tuition, or frankly, another way to view it is we're doing the middle-income scholarship and we're cutting people $86 million instead of $78 million to pay for it. So there is an interplay between cuts, mm-hmm. state appropriation, and the tuition number, and we're anxious to have that dialogue as this process moves forward.
And 1% tuition increase raises how much?
Madam Chair, Senators, is $6 million. Madam Chair, Senator, that's on system-wide, undergraduate, graduate, and professional.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Senator Roebling.
I'm trying to understand.
7 times 6.
So if we increase tuition, I'm just trying to have how many students do you have that pay the full price that don't get any institutional aid? What percent of students don't get any institutional aid that would be affected by a bigger tuition increase?
Madam Chair, Senator
Sullivan.
Approximately 50% of our undergraduate student body receives the financial aid. That's actually a chart I'm going to share with you in a few minutes, we hope. And of that 50%, that's an amount of in excess of $200 million annually. And when you look at that, 12% of those undergraduates, 4,800 students are the founders' students that go to the University of Minnesota tuition and fees free. So approximately 50% of our undergraduates, and we have 29,000 undergraduates.
Madam Chair, if I'll drive on to get to his questions that I think you're anxious to get to. The budget planning strategies, we are looking at administrative reductions, as I mentioned earlier. We didn't discriminate between academic and support units. Everyone's working on that 5.2% reduction. We are looking at human resource strategies to lower costs. As you know, we did anticipate the state having a problem. Just about a year ago, we started an early retirement incentive program that has helped us prepare for this reduction. We didn't expect the reduction to be this challenging, but we've been taking measures and planning for some level of reduction for roughly a year. If you turn to the next page, actions we've already taken. The president has announced a reorganization in the Academic Health Center and in the Graduate School. As I mentioned a minute ago, the retirement incentive option. We've had a hiring pause on. The president has announced an executive salary freeze. Since then, budget instructions have gone out that make an assumption of a salary freeze in the first year of the biennium. And for the University of Minnesota, that always means a hard freeze, again, subject to collective bargaining. But when we do a freeze at the university, that includes, more often than not, my experience, step increases for our bargaining employees. But all of that is subject to collective bargaining. We are modeling further administrative reductions.
Mr. Fitzenreiter, does that include things like the elimination of the graduate school?
Madam Chair, yeah. The reorganization.
Reorganization of the graduate school, okay.
We are looking at the notion of furloughs, haven't made any firm decision. We are looking at the possibility of closing the university down to the extent we can during the next holiday season. There is a time in which we could do that, potentially save energy costs. And people are reducing their printing costs and purchasing activities to try to cope with the pending budget cuts. With that, I'd like to turn to Provost Tom Sullivan to take you through the accountability report and answer some of the questions I think that were asked earlier.
Chair.
Senator Latz.
I'm sorry, I had to step out to have a bill heard in another committee, so I probably missed this part of the presentation. But could I ask you to go back, Mr. Fitzenreiter, to page 7? Were you looking at the mix of state allocation against tuition and fees? And I understand that with, at least with the governor's recommendations for cuts to the U, that the U would become, that the state allocation would end up below 50% of the revenues at the U. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Senator Latz, I would expect that with the governor's cut, and if that holds and it doesn't get any lower, that's our appropriation be about $627 million. Our tuition revenue currently is about $625 million total revenue. So with an increase in tuition, these lines are going to cross, and the state support will be less than 50% of that mix. Yes.
Madam Chair.
Senator Latz.
And then the other major portion of revenue for the university is the grants and research grants and so on, right? And that's in the range of $700
million? $680 to $700 million, yes, okay. In awards annually.
So of the three major sources of revenue for the university, the state allocation, the taxpayers of Minnesota would be funding the smallest portion of that three-legged stool, if you will. Is that right?
Of that three-legged stool, that's correct.
Madam Chair, it just seems like the state of Minnesota is going to become a minority shareholder in our own university.
That's right. Mr. Sullivan.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, since 2001, the university has producing its accountability report, and we have been providing the legislature with this report. As you can see on page 18, we actually organize this accountability report now consistent with our strategic planning goals and objectives, and those are set out on page 18 of your handout. As you know, part of our strategic planning that began in 2004 was to increase the excellence and quality and the reputation of the university. Our aspirational goal is to be within the top three public research universities. You can see on the next page the peer institutions by which we measure and apply metrics to see our progress as we move forward. While it is often the case in discussion that people and institutions like to look at rankings, particularly one commercial ranking, U.S. News, it is the case that no one ranking source captures all of that which one would like to see in terms of measuring performance and impact. And so we have attempted through strategic planning, and each year we report on this in the accountability report, the metrics and measures on those goals and aspirations that we have set out. And you can see that in your handouts. There are a couple I want to mention specifically for the committee this afternoon. On page 19, you will see with regard to the recruitment and enrollment of students, looking particularly at how we approach that The average high school class rank since we have started strategic planning progress has significantly improved. You can see some comparative data there on the charts that we are showing you. And you may ask the immediate question, why the difference from the peer institutions that we're showing and arraying here? Well, our admissions profile is different. Many institutions, particularly these identified here, admit based upon very specific quantitative factors, ACT, SAT, or grade point. At the University of Minnesota, while we look at those very carefully, of course, we take a holistic approach to the admissions. Each of our applications, and in this case, as we speak today, over 33,000 applications for next year's fall entering class, each of those files are looked at individually and in a holistic way. And we look at, of course, the class rank. We look at the rigor of the course work taken. We look at the ACT. And the results I'm sharing with you today show how our students are doing. You can see that the average high school class rank has increased substantially. On the next chart, page 20 of your handout, you can see the increase in ACT scores. And by any measure one looks at and that we report in our accountability, you can see that our progress has been substantial. On the other end of the continuum, we report...
Hold on a second. Senator Michel?
Yes, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Excuse the interruption, but I just want to make sure I have these numbers right. So looking back on page 19, for example, the class ranking... I guess I understand how Berkeley, UCLA, and Michigan are 1, 2, and 3. And you have Minnesota at 10. How big is the peer group you're measuring on, and where does 10 sit within the total peer group? I guess you're 10th in the peer group. I'm trying to figure out how many other institutions you're measuring yourself against. Are you at the bottom there? Are you in the middle?
Madam Chair, Senator, on the previous page, we set forth the list of peer institutions that we measure. And there are 11 there. And to your question, you can see that of the admissions standards, looking at specifically that high school class rank on page 19 that you pointed out, we would come in 10th out of 11th. Again, we do a holistic review of that application file, and we don't pinpoint merely the class rank, although that is an important indicator of success, or merely the ACT.
Well, Madam Chair and Mr. Sullivan, maybe I'm...
Chair Michel.
I'm just not looking at the right page. It's not here. Okay, I don't have a list of the 11. I guess that's what's...
Madam Chair, Senator, my apologies. I thought you had the list. I'll be happy to give those to you orally now. Ohio State University, Penn State University, University of California, Berkeley, UCLA, Florida, Illinois, Michigan, Texas, University of Washington, Seattle, University of Wisconsin-Madison, and Minnesota. My apologies.
Those are the nine above Minnesota?
Those are the total cohort of peer institutions that we measure on a comparative basis.
Thank you.
The next slide, page 20, as I mentioned, has the average ACT, and you can see the progress being made there as well. At the other end of the continuum, and a matter of great importance to us, and that is how well did the students do after they enrolled. You can see here our retention rate, which is a very important measure and indicator for us. We're at 89%, and this year we're projected to be at 90% retention of students after the first year. That measure tells us quite a bit. Most importantly, a high percentage there indicates the success that students are likely to have towards a four-year graduation rate. That's one of our most important indexes for that. Next slide, with regard to graduation rates that follow after that retention number.
Mr. Sullivan, I would just be interested in just an analysis of the 12% or whatever that are not being retained? Are those, is there any particular characteristic to that group?
Madam
For
Chair,
example, are they low income? Are they the founder scholarship? Are they minority?
There are, Madam Chair, there are many reasons for it. I think we've identified five reasons why students may not continue into the second year or beyond. First, some transfer to other institutions. Second, that may be the case because it's not the right fit for them for whatever reason. Third, they may decide to leave the university and join the workforce. Third, they may be unable to continue for academic reasons. They may have been put on probation or dismissed, or for financial reasons. And many that would drop out, that 10% cohort would drop out, may well return and graduate later after they have stepped out for a bit. No university would have 100% retention, I believe, at the end of the first year for a variety of these five or six reasons. We were turning next to the graduation numbers. And here you can see that the university is making very substantial progress. We are not where we would like to be at this time. The Board of Regents has given us new mandates for 4-, 5-, and 6-year graduation rates, and we believe that we are on track to achieve those. Again, we show you on page 22 the comparisons with other peer institutions. And as you can see, there is a relationship, as I noted earlier, between that first-year retention rate and how well students are doing regarding the 4- and 5-year graduation rate. And also, there is a relationship between the academic profile of the students coming in to success in graduating in a timely way.
Madam Chair.
Senator Roebling.
And you just made a comment on this. I was just going to ask. When you talk about what we are seeing on page 22 for graduation rates, and we're talking about what we're seeing on page 19 for admission standards, it does look like there probably is a pretty close correlation for what the standards that Berkeley, UCLA, and Michigan are using and their graduation rates. And you said yours is looking at the whole student, but obviously looking at the top 10% and ACT, SAT scores is a really good indicator of how they're going to do and graduate.
Madam Chair, Senator, that is correct. But as I mentioned earlier, and I want to underscore at this point, particularly with regard to Berkeley and UCLA, the University of California system has a very specific, rigid percentage, and it's the top 4% of students in a formula that they use that can only get into the UC system. We do not put such specificity on that standardized test or on that class rank. We take a broader approach, this more holistic approach, to see what kind of contributions the student can make, the kind and richness of the experience that the student may have had in high school, the particular rigor of the classes taken or not. It's a much broader view, whereas in the UC system, it's all on the numbers. And by statute, it is only the top 4% coming out of the formula they use coming out of the high school classes.
Hi, Madam Chair.
Senator Roebling.
I imagine that would exclude quite a few students, and we'd have a lot of parents who are unhappy that their child couldn't get into our own university system.
Mr. Fuller's child did not get into it. He's unhappy. And he's got pull.
Yeah.
I didn't want to go there.
Oh. Yeah, now you say that.
Madam Chair.
Yeah, Senator Latz.
There's going to be a fundamental tension here between access and quality. I mean, at some point, we keep cutting the budget for the U, and they don't have the resources to admit as many students, period, let alone Minnesota students, that might otherwise qualify at some academic threshold. I mean, to do that, you end up raising the academic threshold, or you have to backfill it with tuition aid or grants or something like that. But at some point, you can't have it all. I mean, you simply can't have total access and total quality if you keep slashing the resources to the university. I mean, what you're going to end up with, instead of a land-grant university, is an NIH and Pell Grant university.
And that's the direction that we're going. So I'm a little frustrated. Everyone says we want all access. We want every kid who can get in the top 25% of their class, or the top 40% of their high school class, to be able to access University of Minnesota. And at the same time, we're saying we're taking another $150 million out of your budget. Do what you can. And don't raise tuition, by the way, either. Your only other viable source of revenue. We can't do it. I mean, at some point, we've got to make a decision as a population, as a state, on behalf of them in the Senate. What are our priorities going to be? And if this isn't going to be that priority, let's just acknowledge it on the table and allow the university to tighten up their funnel so they can at least serve well the students they're able to admit. If we really want them to provide that kind of total access, then let's provide them the funding to do it.
Okay, proceed.
Madam Chair, on page 23, this is a chart that shows you a different part of our university and a very important one. Our conversation up till this point has been largely looking at undergraduate profiles and comments. Here, this shows you the degrees actually awarded by the university, and you can see that in that peer group that I identified earlier, the University of Minnesota is second in awarding doctorate degrees, third in awarding master's degrees, second in awarding professional degrees such as first professional law, dentistry, pharmacy, and ninth in awarding bachelor's degree. And I think this is important to point out because frequently when we think of the University of Minnesota, we think of undergraduate enrollment and access questions, but a very large part of our university is professional education and graduate education. And this is really important for that quality workforce that Minnesota needs and wants to be able to produce people with graduate degrees into the workforce, as well as to have our graduates become teachers of other institutions and have that kind of leadership influence across sectors and the country. Finally, this afternoon, I would like to turn to some data that go directly to some questions that you asked earlier with regard to scholarships. On page 25, you'll see the array of the information that we were alluding to earlier. On the top left hand, you'll see all degree-seeking students and the number of students with university scholarships or waivers, the percentage of students, and the total dollars awarded. Dropping down is a column with regard to undergraduate students. Again, arraying the total number of students, the percentage, and the dollar awards. And then on the right-hand column, answers to specific questions that were posed earlier in writing with regard to our endowment funds, the number of programs, and the endowment values that support specific scholarship programs. And with that, we will be happy to entertain any comments or questions.
Madam Chair, members, Senator, just have a few other slides to highlight for you before we wrap this up.
Okay.
On slide 26, there were a series of questions, written questions we received from the committee staff, and I believe you have a written narrative document that gives you some background information on those items. I'm not going to spend a great deal of time going through those. I will tell you that I do want to highlight just quickly for you, if you turn the next page, the status of the stadium and the biomedical facilities authority. As you recall, while this is a picture here of the stadium, I do want to tell the committee the stadium is on track, on time, on budget. We've the current price tag on the stadium, the all-in cost, is roughly $301 million. As you know, the state supported us with $137.2 million of bonding authority, in which the state has a statutory appropriation to provide us about $10.2 million a year to support that appropriation. That debt has been issued. That money has been spent on the stadium. We were, just to highlight for you, that when that legislation was passed, that legislation contemplated debt service for 25 years from the state on that stadium, and because of the way we were able to fashion the issuance of that debt, in combination with the interest rate we received on that debt, we were able to cut that debt from 25 years to 22 years, saving the state about $30 million on the back end of the original legislation. And as I said, the project's on track, on time. The project has actually received a safety award. Mortenson Construction, who's the general contractor, received a safety award from the state. Our women and minority-owned business participation in this project has been a great success. Over 30% of the dollars that we've contracted for construction have gone to women and minority business. This has been a great success. We worked very hard at it. So far, the stadium, as I said, is on track, and we're looking forward to a September 12th opening, and we're in fact planning a scrimmage game before the official opening just to do the shakedown on the stadium. With that, I'll turn just to the next slide that places in context of the stadium the planning that we're doing for the next set of projects that have been authorized by the state with respect to the medical biosciences program. And we are in the process now of master planning the district. So this just gives you, in one sense, a cartoon, but a real future look at what the development there will potentially look like many years from now. As you know, this is where we're going to construct the next four medical biosciences building. The first project in those four, the Center for Magnetic Resonance Research, is just about completed with design. We expect to start construction sometime later this spring. As I mentioned, we are master planning the entire site. It is an opportunity not just to put four buildings over near the stadium, but to really plan a campus, in a sense, because this is a large expansion of the campus. The Board of Regents has authorized the $292 million of construction projects for this site, for those four buildings. We will be selling the first part of that, roughly $16 million of that $292 million, in the next probably month and a half. That will begin the construction of the CMRR project. So again,
you'll be able to find buyers?
Madam Chair, members, we just completed the sale of, it was tough last fall. We delayed the sale of $41 million related to the TCF Bank Stadium debt because interest rates were simply too high last fall. And just about a month ago, less than a month ago, we were able to sell that debt. We had subscriptions for that $41 million in the neighborhood of $250 million worth of folks wanting to buy that debt. Our interest rates were down at around 4.5%. So things are calming down. You can sell tax-exempt debt in this market if you have good credit, and we feel very good about the rates and the money we sold.
Can you just tell us what the other buildings are?
The three other buildings will relate to cancer, infectious disease, and cardiovascular. And they should all be built by 2015 to 2016. They will go in staggered phases.
Okay.
Madam Chair?
Senator Latz.
Mr. Fitzenrider, have you received any feedback from the fact that TCF has moved their corporate headquarters or their organization, their state of incorporation, or whatever they did, to South Dakota rather than Minnesota, even though they are the signature name on the University of Minnesota's football stadium?
Madam Chair, Senator, I haven't personally had any phone calls or feedback or negative comments with respect to that.
Well, here's one.
Well, Madam Chair, let me add two. And I would have thought there would have been a 10% fee on naming rights for any company that has naming rights and moves out of the state. So you didn't have that in the contract?
Mr. Fitzman.
Madam Chair, Senator, no, we did have and do have in the contract provisions, if they were ever bought, about what the name could or couldn't become. But we hadn't thought about the, frankly, about the possibility they might move their corporate headquarters.
Mr. Fitzenrider, on these smaller programs, did you indicated on the handout if they're if their base funding and their continued funding? Like, for example, the India Center, was that one time?
It's non-recurring.
It's non-recurring. Neighborhood Alliance?
Non-recurring.
Non-recurring. Dakota Language Program?
Recurring.
Oh, that's good. I was worried about that. And the
Renewable Resources,
is 1.55 recurring.
Yep.
Industrial Relations added to the base. And U Mail Partnership is recurring. Okay. Sounds good. Senator Sharon.
On the Renewable Resource Organic Farming Report that you are not speaking to specifically, I would like you to talk to that. I know that you're aware that there was a commitment, even though it wasn't articulated specifically in the legislation, that there'd be $400,000 per year of increase, that's new spending. And I don't see, I can't differentiate from how you've articulated this, what's new and what's sustained. And I just want to make certain that I understand how the $400,000 per year was spent in new spending for, which was a commitment that was made when we made this appropriation.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
My name is Bev Durgan. I'm Dean of University of Minnesota Extension and Director of the Minnesota Agricultural Experiment Station. And that appropriation went to the Experiment Station and to Extension. And we have used that funding at $400,000 in both recurring and non-recurring ways, but the $400,000 recurring is that we have hired faculty. We are in the process of also hiring some additional faculty. We are converting the dairy facility at the West Central Research and Outreach Center in Morris to an organic facility. We have also hired 4 graduate students on this project, and we'll continue to, we're looking for 2 additional graduate students. We have reassigned and redirected a senior faculty member, Rob King, to oversee all the organic programs within the University of Minnesota, and he's working closely with the Minnesota Department of Ag on the State Organic Task Force. He also will be advising a graduate student and also has some recurring funding on getting the faculty together to work more in organic and sustainable. So we have a number of those projects. I can give you more information, but we have.
I want to make certain that we're very clear about what is new spending, what's recurring or reassigned. You know, for example, the movement of just referring to, I think you were talking about a reassignment of Rob King to the organic coordinator position is really a reassignment and not new spending. So, I just want to be very clear that it's not muddy, that we're very clear about what is the new spending as committed, where we made that commitment to new spending and not, using it to support already existing programs.
Dean Durgan.
Chair, Senator, this is new funding. Rob King was department head of the Department of Applied Economics. He stepped down from that. We did rehire a new chair. So this is new funding that is paying Rob King's salary as it in his new assignment in his position. So it's not reassignment. It is new funding.
So you'd be willing to write that out very explicitly for me so it's clear what is new spending, what is being
the chair? Absolutely.
We hear a lot from organic farmers who are really looking to the university to be a leader in this area in terms of research and organics. So, I mean, there was just a big thing last week, so that's why it's all on our minds. So I think there's a huge market for organics that's growing in the United States, and there's a lot of interest from legislators in this area as well. So we really encourage you to increase your commitment to organics.
Right. And, Madam Chair, as we have spoken, is that the University of Minnesota has the most certified organic acreage of any land-grant university in the U.S. We also will be the first land-grant university in the U.S. that will have an organic dairy that is operating right next to a traditional dairy so that we can have direct comparison of organic versus traditional. We are one of the few land-grant universities that is running a student organic farm on our St. Paul campus. the students not only participate in converting land to organic, but also sell it at a farmer's market. And we've now committed additional acreage on the St. Paul campus to convert additional acreage to to organic, to have our undergraduate students experience how you move from a more traditional agriculture to organic, and also then marketing and how you contribute that. So we are taking this very seriously. We are also one of the few land-grant universities that still have a large breeding program in soybeans, in non-GMO soybeans. And, in fact, Minnesota produces over 20% of the organic soybeans in the U.S., and those are all University of Minnesota variety releases. So
and
we
very
have
popular in Europe, I'm
right.
sure.
And we have a large commitment to organic, and we'll continue to do that. And I'll be more than happy to sit down and talk to you more about that if you'd like me to.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I would like in writing, though, I think that the best way to really track what we're doing is to understand what was, what is new, and then we can use that as a baseline for future discussions about how investments are being continued and maintained in this area. Right.
Senator Erickson-Ropes.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Senator Sharon, for asking the question. I want to let you know as well that I'm very interested in this topic, being the co-chair of the Ag Committee. It's of particular interest, and back in my district in southeastern Minnesota, we have between 200 and 300 small organics farms. So we're very interested in keeping our eyes on this, and I just want to make sure to clarify. And it seems to be, according to the little write-up here, that these new faculty hires are going to be dealing explicitly with organics research and organics outreach and development, that sort of thing. They're not hired with organics dollars, because I think Senator Sharon and I both carried a couple of those organics bills for organic livestock and other initiatives. So these new hires are going to be dealing specifically with organics.
Dean Durgan.
Madam Chair, Senator, they will be dealing specifically with organics, but I think it's also important to realize is that it's not just the organic production, it's the conversion to organic and how organic fits mm-hmm. into the system. So their main focus will be organic, but we also have many other faculty that also work in the organic area. So they work in organics, work in more traditional, and work in that whole continuum of sustainable. But the new faculty we are hiring, their main focus will be in organic. Mm-hmm. Extension, research, and teaching.
I'm sorry to cut off this conversation, but we have a member from the public who wants to address this briefly, and then we're going to have to adjourn the committee. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate your time. Appreciate you waiting, Dean Durgan. We knew this question was going to come up at some point. Yeah. Mary O'Connor. Sorry to leave you till the end, and we only have a few minutes left, but thank you for your patience.
Thank Welcome. You. Madam Chair and members, my name is Mary Galen O'Connor. I worked for the University of Minnesota for 39 years. The university spent $50 million for a computer system which created chaos at the university. $50 million to create chaos. It began July 1st, and now, 8 months later, it still has many problems. But no executive employees of the university were fired for this gross incompetence. Three regents are running for reappointment to the Board of Regents, but they didn't mind spending $50 million or creating chaos at the university. What kind of oversight did the regents provide in this huge waste of the public's and students' money?
Ms. O'Connor, are you retired from the university?
Right now I am retired.
And what department did you work in?
It was under the Controller's Department.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Proceed.
Cut the university's funding by $50 million so they can learn from their serious mistake. If there are no consequences for their behavior, they will repeat it. I also have some suggestions for the university to cut its expenses. Sell the Rosemont Experiment Station, sell the university golf course, close the Rochester campus. For the students, eliminate most of the student service fees. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. We appreciate those comments, and we will certainly inquire about the computer system.
Thank you.
Thanks. Okay, with that, Senator Erickson-Rupps?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Just one comment. I missed most of this meeting, but I want to let you know I was doing the work of higher education since I was meeting with about 100 nursing students from Winona State. And, you know, they have a lot of fresh reports about, especially the seniors in the nursing program, how internships that had been readily available in the past are drying up, and a lot of graduating nursing students are really worried about where their job's going to be, opportunities for hires, because even just in the metro area, I think since December there have been 610 healthcare worker layoffs.
Supposed to be a shortage.
Yeah. We do have a shortage, but also, of course, layering the economic crisis on top of things. Hospital systems and healthcare systems are laying off people. We've just had reported on the statewide tours in Winona. If the governor's budget passes as proposed, they will be immediately laying off 115 healthcare workers in Winona, and which
at the hospital,
at our hospital and nursing home. So it's bad out there, and I'm hearing this news from our students who are still in the system.
Thank you. Our next meeting will be on Thursday, and that is to interview the regent candidates, and that will be in the SOB in what room? 200. So the meeting is adjourned.